Hi, loyal listeners. I have something I want to talk to you about. I am wondering where you are listening to The Professor Is In, and I am hoping that you are joining us on the Himalaya. We love the Himalaya app for several reasons. Number one, it's super easy to use. Number two, it has all the podcasts that you love. And for us, most importantly, it is the place that you can come to for premium content from The Professor Is In. That means our Facebook Live recordings, previous webinar recordings, AMAs, where you can ask us anything, which is what AMA stands for, right? So hop on over to Himalaya, check it out, think about becoming a premium member, low price of $7.99 a month, and you get direct access to us whenever you need to.
Welcome to the Professor Is In podcast. I am Dr. Karen Kelski.
And I am Kel Weinhold.
And we are happy that you are here with us again today. We are actually interrupting our regularly scheduled programming to offer you a late-breaking podcast episode that is going to share with you the insights that we learned from this week's Dispatches from the Frontlines blog post series. So first off, just to explain what the new Dispatches series is. It's something that we have done now for 3 weeks, and we're going to keep doing it for a while. And it was really your idea, Kel. So why don't you describe what it's about?
Well, basically, I kept seeing these questions pop up from clients and across Twitter and everywhere else that seemed like we could certainly answer them. Believe me, there's no short of opinions around here. But it seemed like we really wanted to hear what other people had to say about it. We really wanted to say, okay, what are you doing out there on the front lines with these challenging questions? So the first question was, how do you handle a difficult teen? Mm-hmm. Admittedly, we could talk about difficult teens, but between the two of us, we've only had one, and it would become really clear who it was, so it'd get pretty awkward, right? Right? And then the second question was, how, as an international student who is interviewing in a non-native language, what's the best way to prep for interviews? I can give you my advice, but I've never had the experience. Mm-hmm. And then there's this one, which really is why we're here today.
Right.
This one blew up.
Yeah, this one blew up. So we had 7 answers in week one, and we had 6 responses in week two. And this week, we're not even done with the week yet, and we already have 50 responses and counting. So it really touched a nerve. And the question was, search committee members, what do you wish candidates knew?
Yeah.
What mistakes do you see them continually making? And boy, did that get a response. So we realized, wow, we're still in the campus visit season. This is still a dynamic and evolving situation for many, many people who are on the job market. And we can get this podcast out to you in a 4-day turnaround. Our production team kindly agreed to actually make that possible for us and for you. So thank you, production team. Mm-hmm. And so we are sitting here. It's 9 o'clock at night. We're recording it, and we're going to get it out to you on Tuesday.
There are actually people still doing interviews, too. I'm working with people who are on interview interventions who are still at the first stage interview.
Sure. So we're not going to spend the podcast walking you through 50 responses. Actually, we're going to break it down into the 3 main themes that we have seen emerging so far. By the way, there will be a blog post about this, and the blog post is going to be out on Monday. So you're actually going to have kind of a 1-2 punch, so to speak, reading the blog post Monday, hearing this podcast on Tuesday about what are all the responses. But the themes to really break down into, like I said, 3 themes, except the 3 themes are almost variations of 1 theme.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we noticed. But to summarize them, first of all, number one, people are failing to respond to what the job ad actually asked for.
Mm-hmm.
Number two.
At every level.
What's that?
And that's at every level. That's at their cover letter.
Mm-hmm.
They're not tailoring their cover letters. They're not tailoring their interview answers. They're not tailoring their job talks. They're
Right.
Yeah.
Number two, people are failing to research the department and the university, so they show up without the foggiest idea of anything that the department actually does or that the university is actually known for.
Mm-hmm.
And then number three, people are failing to actually know who the real people are,
right.
who they're meeting,
right.
And what they're doing and what they work on, and to show an interest in the people that they're meeting.
Mm-hmm.
at the point of interview or campus visit. So mm-hmm. you can see that although we listed those as three themes, those are really all one
it's
theme.
It's just one theme. Lack of research.
Yeah, a lack of research. So we decided when we were talking about it that in a way, there are two problems. One is a lack of research, like we just said. And the more important problem is that candidates' messaging is off. Mm-hmm. Candidates mm-hmm. are not telling a story of themselves that is making sense to the listeners who they're actually meeting. And so that's what we wanted to talk about today. And so, Kel, you actually were saying, we don't need to talk about research. They know how to do research.
Right, right. I was being optimistic that we don't have to spend a bunch of time on this podcast telling people how to research a university. For heaven's sakes, they have PhDs. Aaron begged to differ.
Yeah. I mean, I just feel like we would be remiss if we didn't talk to you, if we didn't just remind you that you have big, giant brains, you know how to do research, don't segregate those giant research brains over in your research lives and forget to use them for the job search. Mm-hmm. So look at the website. Look at the course catalog. Look at the CVs of the major people you'll be meeting in the department. And then you, as a former comms person, you were saying...
Right, that basically one of the places that people miss all the time, and I know it's because everybody's being a big brain, but there's a news and comm department in every university. There is a department that is devoted to pushing news out about the university. Almost every department now on their website, they have a news and events section. You can understand the ethos of that university and that department by what they're promoting, what they're pushing out there. So go look at it. Do the critical analysis that you were trained to do.
It's funny that you should mention that because just this morning, as I was eating my breakfast, I was thumbing through the Berkeley Astronomy Department's 10-page newsletter.
Oh, that is glossy. So embarrassing.
Well,
it's like nerd capital of the world. What'd you read with your breakfast? Well, I was reading the Berkeley's Astronomy.
And the reason that I got that is because Miyako, our college-age daughter, mm-hmm. Who's now a junior, when she was a freshman, her very first semester, she took an astronomy class. And it's an astronomy class, one of the science for humanists classes they offer. And she just fell in love with the professor. She couldn't have had a better experience. And so when he asked for money to support their telescope or their observatory or something, I gave them money. And now I get their newsletter. All that to say, that is a digression, all that to say that big, rich departments produce a lot of this marketing material. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, if you're in classics in a small regional college, okay, that's going to be different, not going to have the same depth of information. The point is you can find something. You can. Mm-hmm. And so use your big brain, figure it out. And then I also wanted to say before we leave research behind that it isn't just these big things that show up on the department website, mm-hmm. Or I should say the university website as, look, one of our people won the Nobel Prize. Okay, that's huge. It also comes down to tiny, tiny distinctions in wording that the department chose when they decided how to describe what they do. Because every word on that website is the product of like 25 faculty meetings and so much argument mm-hmm. and angst and, you know, rending of your, what do you rend?
Clothing.
You rend your clothing. Yeah.
Tearing of hair might be better rending of clothing is usually a grief thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess so. Anyway, just a lot of battles fought over we are X and not Y. And so you want to make sure that when you read those descriptions, even if it's one or two paragraphs of who we are as a department, they are signaling in every word what they want you to understand about them.
Let me give you a quick example. Small regional university pulls a mostly local group of students, and those students are very much going to college to better their income potential and to get better jobs. And you go to a history department website. And on that history department website, it says very clearly that you're preparing for history for business, to go to law school, mm-hmm. because it helps you understand the world and the context in it. They are signaling to you in every way possible that when you come here and propose a course, when you come here and you start talking about how you're going to teach the history of X or Y, you need to keep in mind that it is being done through a lens of preparation for success in business or for their job prospects, not just for the theoretical exploration. So there's information to be gathered there mm-hmm. for you to be able to give that information. Give yourself back to them in a way that they say, oh, you get us.
Mm-hmm. Or for, you know, anthropology, some department might say we're an empirically motivated department. Another department might say we're a theoretically motivated department. And boy, those are one word difference and an app light years apart in terms of every last thing they do, from their intro class all the way up to their graduate seminars and how they train PhD students. Mm-hmm. So you have to attend to those things.
And you have to figure out if you're a continental philosopher and the department you're going into is all analytical. And mm-hmm. you're like, but there's nobody like me. I don't understand how am I supposed to say who I am or how I connect to them? Right. That's the thing. You right. have to figure out how you do.
Yeah. So they invited you for the interview. Remember that. So right. they're interested. They're they interested. Know what you do. They can see it.
They didn't trick them. Right. Like, oh, we misread that CV and we spent all that money to bring you here. Mm-hmm. That's not the way it works.
Right.
Anyway.
So
onward.
That's research. But now we're going to move on now because what we want to talk to you about is delivering your message. How are you the best brand representative for your brand?
Karen basically just stepped in front of the bullet for me. I come out of communications and have done a lot of, I mean, I came out of communications and journalism, but then into communications and in particular strategic communication. So I'm very interested in the messaging that's delivered. And I do all of the interview prep. And I talk about with clients all the time about brand. How are you delivering your three brands? And so if that word causes you some kind of reactivity, just, I don't know, beep it or think of a different word, but persona, mm-hmm.
oh yeah,
identity.
No. First of all, but I have to step back for a second. Why did you say, how are you delivering your three brands? What does that mean?
I was about to go on to that. Thank you. I'm glad you said that because I probably would have gotten distracted.
Okay.
Like Karen said, it is 9 o'clock at night. This is my bedtime.
I know. So, I'm a night owl, but Kel most certainly is not.
Good luck on keeping me on track here. Okay. So the three things that you have to be as a scholar, I mean, as a faculty member, right? Mm-hmm. You have to deliver your scholarship brand, mm-hmm. your teaching brand, and your service brand / collegiality brand. You have to be delivering every question you ever get anywhere at any visit is aiming at one of those three.
Okay, so I would have thought, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I would have said you have one brand and that single brand encompasses those three elements and has to find expression through those three elements. But is that not how you would put it?
Oh yeah, I guess we can drill down on the use of the word brand. We could say Coors is a brand, mm-hmm. and these are their different beers. Does right. Coors have more than one beer? I don't even know.
Well, sure, everybody has more than one beer now because, like, everybody has pretending like they live in Portland and have a beard and wear.
But we're still all one
flannel.
I don't know, but can we not do that? Let's just three products within your brand.
Yeah,
I don't care.
Yeah,
but you get my point.
That. I like that. So, and by the way, the other word that one can use, the word that I used these many years since I started doing job market workshops back when I was still in grad school, is a platform. I like the word platform because it's like you're in a political campaign and you are campaigning to get votes. And you literally are campaigning for votes. So it's not that big of a stretch. And yet, say that you are taking your message and you're speaking to steelworkers in Pittsburgh, as if there are any steelworkers left in Pittsburgh, but whatever. Or you're taking it to uber wealthy Democratic donors. Your platform has to be consistent. You have mm-hmm. to be the same candidate. Mm-hmm. And identifiable across those two different contexts, even though the needs and the preoccupations of those two groups couldn't really be more different. So this
or
is
what you might highlight, right?
So sure. So the brand is consistent.
Right.
It's just you're highlighting different elements, and I just feel like that's another very useful word to use.
Okay, so let's stick with platform. We're going to talk about three places where your messaging goes awry: your interview, your campus visit, and your job talk.
Yes.
As in all of the places. I just looked at that list. It was like, that's the whole thing.
Plus your cover letter, your teaching statement, and your research statement.
Oh my goodness.
That's sorry, not, we're like, laughing with you, not at you.
Many of you have really just made such dramatic changes in those things. And I think that we get a little bit like, well, everybody has got it now, right? And then we see that they don't. We get these 50 responses and we think, wow, we really need to keep pushing this. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're doing. So there are a ton of questions to prepare for the interview. There's all sorts of variables. We're not going to go through them all. That would be a whole bunch of podcasts. But
yeah, or, you know, our webinar recording that we have, which is the interview intervention webinar, which you are welcome to go look at if you want to. On our website.
Karen's always so good at plugging in what we do. I'm I'm always just a little bit chagrined. Like I do interview interventions and you can work. I'm going to have to do some reflecting on my resistance to promoting myself. Anyway, there are a bunch of questions that you can prepare for. There are two questions you absolutely must know inside and out, and you must be able to adapt them to whichever place that you are talking to, and they require an incredible amount of precision and research. The first question is, and most people can't do this, so don't feel bad. Tell us about your research. So you're sitting there, the Skype camera comes on, everybody introduces themselves awkwardly. There's that one person over on the edge you can't really see. Other person's looking at their phone and they say, hey, thank you for having me, you know, coming today. This is who we are. So could you take a minute and tell us about your research? Then the train begins to run off the track because the first mistake you make in delivering your message is believing that they care about your research. Mm-hmm.
That's the mistake of all interview questions, is because they asked it, you think they care about your answer. They do care about your, they care about your answer intently, intensely care about your answer. The point is they need to know that you can quickly and concisely sketch out the who, what, when, where, how of your research, and then they can just move on to the next thing because they don't care about the specifics. They just need to know that you do it, that it's legitimate, and that it's funded and published. And then can we please move on?
Okay. You are right now. Karen is reflecting the level of frustration we saw in the answers from the faculty members who searched on search, who are on search committees. There was a high level of frustration.
Yeah.
But let's just take this down a notch in terms of understanding that every single sentence in your answer about your research needs to be instrumentalized. It needs to tell them, it needs to position you in the field. It needs to tell them the kind of methods you do. And it needs to tell them why we care. And that's it. Don't go into a big, deep dive.
Yep. And not a monologue. I mean, it has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and boom. And then there's silence, and they can then ask the next question, which is what they're waiting to do. Mm-hmm. So don't forget that. It's a dialogue, not a monologue. Number two, we're still on the interview thing. The question that we're doing this emergency intervention about is why this job? Mm-hmm. What made you want this job? And they will ask it in a range of ways. Why do you want this job? Why do you want to work at Middle Tennessee State? Or how do you see your work fitting into the work we do here at the department? Or 10 other ways it might come at you. But it will come at you. Sometimes it's actually the very first question. Oftentimes it's the very last question.
No, it's often the first question nowadays.
That's interesting.
Yeah. In fact, I wrote at another blog post about that, about how increasingly I'm hearing from clients that it is the right out of the gate. Why you? Why is it? Why you're interested? So the most important thing I can tell you here is that it has to be about them, not you. They don't want to hear about why it's good for you. The sentence, there should not be a sentence that says, you have a great research facility and that will be really good for my work. Mm-hmm. I'm very excited to have this museum here because I'll finally have a collection that I can use. It's not about you. It's about them. The job search is about them.
Right.
So your job is to figure out how to deliver why you belong there without ever saying the word fit. And you do that by saying, I get who you are here. And I do it too.
And what problems of theirs do you solve?
Right.
Without naming them as
problems. Without naming them as problems.
But you're going to come in, you're going to teach the classes without a problem. They're not going to have any hassle with you. You're just going to get some publications done. You're going to raise the prestige. You're going to bring in funding or get funding. And you're just going to do what they need done. That's the answer to the fit question. It's about them, not you.
So think about the answer like this. You do this. And so do I. Here's someone I can be in conversation with. Here's someone I can collaborate with. Here's some institutes I can be involved with. Here are some classes I can teach.
Mm-hmm.
Not, you know what? My mom lives down the road.
Yeah. I have a blog post about that as well.
We're on the blog post thing.
Yeah.
But really, we've been doing this for this particular thing for almost a decade. So we are referencing a lot of information that's out there. Okay, the next one.
The campus visit. We're on the campus visit.
Right.
And so judging from the 50 responses we had and the three themes that we mentioned, which is not researching and then managing your message and controlling and disciplining it as you go into the next stage, the campus visit, you are under surveillance from the minute you step off out of the gate at the airport and they pick you up and you get into that car. You are under surveillance until the minute you walk through the doors of the airport to depart.
Mm-hmm.
And they are surveilling you for three things. Mm-hmm. And what are they?
Your scholarship, your tenurability, and your collegiality.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that collegiality is dual. Both, do they like you? Like, do they, are you going to be an asshole at a faculty meeting? Mm-hmm. Do they like you? But also, are you going to positively impact their labor load? Meaning, reduce it.
Mm-hmm.
Not positively reduce, but anyway. The point is, are you going to take some of their labor or are you going to increase their labor? Because
yeah.
if you're going to increase their labor, you're a problem. And if the problem of increasing their labor is emotional, that you just can't even handle yourself and they have to take care of you, that's the same kind of problem.
Right.
So as you go talk to all these people on the campus visit, you're answering those three questions, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're aiming at those three, like I talked about, the sort of platforms. Here's my scholarship. Here's what I'm going to be doing with it. Here's my potential for tenure with that scholarship, because I know at this university, this is what you expect for tenure.
So at one university, they might expect a monograph and five articles. At another university, they expect only a monograph or five articles. And at another college, they expect three articles and that's it.
Right.
And so you have to know that going in. I'm not saying you have to be a mind reader and know every last detail, but basically you have to understand colleges and universities fall into certain categories and ranks and that those track onto expectations for tenure and know what they basically are and then show how you're going to meet them and not vastly under meet them or vastly over exceed them. Because if you come into a tiny teaching college where they only want to see a couple of articles and you say, well, I will certainly in the next 5 years be producing two monographs as well as launching a research center, they're going to say, okay, no, pass. You don't belong here on this campus.
Well, this goes back to the research question. You did not research that university. The way you research there, what's the expectation for tenure is? Before you get there, as you look at the CVs of the people who have been hired in, say, the last 7 years or so, look at their pace of publication. Look and see what they've done. If you're going to be sitting across from somebody who just got tenure and they did three articles because they're teaching a 5-5 load or a 4-4 load, and you're talking about how you're going to do six articles, they're not going to hire you.
Mm-hmm.
Because guess what? If you came there, if they hired you, you're signaling you're going to leave. Because I want to be at an R1.
Mm-hmm.
So pay attention.
Right. Yeah. You were telling me that...
Oh, yeah, one of the things.
One of the best pieces of advice that you pulled from your quick survey of the answers we have so far is that the candidates should come in with one unique question tailored to the individuals that they're meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, other than that, don't be afraid to repeat yourself because, again, remember, it's your platform, it's your brand, whichever of those words works for you, and you need to deliver that consistently over and over and over.
I just prepped somebody for an interview today that had, I think they had like eight people or nine people for 2 days in a row. It was a really, really dense campus visit. And you're going to say the same things. They're going to ask you, tell us about your research. What's your plan? How do you see this? Where do you see yourself contributing? How do you see yourself? Where are opportunities for your collaboration? They're going to ask you all the way through. It's okay if you repeat there.
Mm-hmm.
But what you need to do is go in and say, this person studies this thing, and I have a question about that.
Mm-hmm.
And this person studies something completely different than mine, but I have a question that's going to show that I know what you study. And I'm thinking about it as a way we can converse.
So look, great example. I'm a Japan anthropologist. I always interviewed at four field anthro departments, which meant that I usually ended up talking to primatologists and archaeologists. I'm a cultural anthropologist, so it was very hard to find stuff to talk to them about. But the thing about talking to archaeologists was, and is, that there's tremendously rich archaeology done in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
It's not my field. I don't do it. But when you work in Japan, you do, as an anthropologist, you you kind of, you know, encounter it now and again. It's contested because the issues of, you know, the role of Korea versus the role of China, it's in the news a lot. And so what I could end up speaking with an archaeologist about would not be about the details of their work in archaeology. I'm not qualified to do that. But I could certainly say, oh, I noticed when I was looking up some of your publications that you have actually done a little bit of work with some colleagues in Japan, and I was wondering if you've spent a lot of time there. And then that's a great question, because they're going to say, oh my gosh, I go to Japan every chance I get, and I collaborate with a guy at University of Tokyo. And suddenly we're off and running, and our 30 minutes flies by. Because we've spent it connecting over the best ramen place in Tokyo. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of thing you want to do.
But I also think that you can do that same approach. You know, I think it's great when you have the social connections, but I think you can also think about that with the intellectual approaches, right? So you're a geographer and you're a cultural, you know, you're looking at cultural geography or geography of people. And some candidate comes in and they're all GIS mapping. Mm-hmm. That's what they do. They do GIS mapping.
They don't
mapping.
Do people.
I don't do people. I map. If I'm a GIS person coming in and I'm talking to this, and I'm sorry if I'm getting the words wrong and it's not cultural geography, but the geography of people, I'm going to have a question that says, hey, you know, I noticed your recent work that you've been doing on, you know, structures of communities in X place. And I wonder where you see the potential, any kind of potential for GIS being able to add to or engage with
sure.
that. You're showing them, I know what you do.
Yes.
I respect it to the same level that I respect my own work. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually thinking about how we could talk to each other.
Right. Yeah, that's you're totally true.
And
by the way, I do think it's called cultural geography.
Okay. I don't know. And I that's what it sounded right. But then I thought a lot of things sound right to me. They're not right. So
yeah, that's not really the criterion.
Right. But I want to make something really clear in that. Pay attention to the structure of that question. I did not come in and say, hey, I do GIS. How do you think you can use that?
Right.
I didn't put you first. So pay close attention to the structure. It's always them first and then you second.
Right. And then just moving on to the job talk, like we said we would. To paraphrase one of the respondents to dispatches, they are either too broad to be scholarly or too specific to be intelligible to anyone except a couple of specialists in the room. Mm-hmm. So many bad job talks. That was a quote. Mm-hmm. So because there are so many bad job talks, and this is actually one of my leading motivators from the minute I started The Professor Is In, that I have blogged and written about job talks to great length. So today, in terms of just the mastering your message theme that we're talking about for you just today, your job talk cannot be about every single thing you know and everything you've done. It's too much. And that is, in fact, the typical problem with most job talks is that you're
talking about my dissertation.
Yeah, which is, you know, 7 chapters long, and I'm going to talk about all 7 chapters. And you have to actually edit. And I wish Project Runway were still with us, because Tim Gunn was so great, because he would go in there and he would say, you know, one ruffle is good doesn't mean 10 ruffles is better. It's one ruffle that is good, and don't overdo it. And so you have to edit, he would always say. Mm-hmm. And it's the same with your job talk. Take one small part of your doctoral research, just one part, and go into the who, what, when, where, why of it, or the how, I should say, sorry, who, what, when, where, how, also the why, and do it well. And then your audience can extrapolate from that you know how to do a bigger project. They just don't need to hear about every last bit of it in the 40 minutes.
And really, people do not understand the structure of a job talk. It is the place where we see people go so very, very far afield. And I talked to somebody today doing a job talk intervention, which I do. It's a strategy thing that's just 30 minutes that tells you exactly what your job talk should have, what goes where, how to do it, where people go wrong. And he said, this is such an exhaustive example of how to do this compared to the little weird hints you get in the department. Mm-hmm. You ask a question, they just give you strange little ideas of what you're supposed to do.
And don't pitch it too high.
Right.
Don't pitch it too low. Okay, thanks.
Thank you. What does that mean? But the one thing that I see people do over and over and over again is that they try to talk about too much. Mm-hmm. They don't pick a very specific thing, and they don't pick a thing that speaks to the job.
Right. You have to, right. Of the seven chapters of your dissertation, I guess most dissertations are not actually seven chapters, but whatever. Anyway, let's say five. Pick the one that is most closely connected to the actual ad, the things that the ad said they were focusing on, that they were prioritizing.
Right. Like pick it. Like if the job ad says they want someone who does critical race theory,
then talk about critical race theory in the job talk and not, and make it explicit, not implicit, explicit. Okay. So I actually think this is a very good moment to just point out that the reason you do a job 30-minute job talk strategy session as your primary offering for the job talk is because you used to do job talk interventions where people would come to you with their job talks and would give you a shortened version of it so that you could then, you know, evaluate it and help work on it. And the trouble was they were always universally so terrible that didn't work as a service to provide because nobody's job talk was ready to be edited at that point. Well, or edited also, is not the word. No, what is it? They weren't ready to be delivered. Yeah,
delivered. And I'd had this moral dilemma. You know, people would come with their job talk with 2 weeks to go or a week before their thing and say, here it is. And I'd say, oh man, what am I going to fix? Because there's not enough time to fix it. I'm not going to take their feet out from under them so they don't have any confidence. What do I do? And it was just too stressful. It's like, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm just going to tell you how to do the job talk and then Karen can edit it. But I cannot stand this.
Right.
And I just, as a communication scholar, I abhor bad talks. I just,
You always did.
I did. Every time we've ever gone to one,
I know,
and
we go to academic talks and they'll, some person, professor will be reading from their paper up at the podium and I'm listening because that's what professors do. And then Kel is next to me sighing and
just give me the damn paper to read. I don't have to listen, read it to me for heaven's sake. It's just dumb. Anyway, we digress.
Moving
the Q&A
on.
Is the last part.
The Q&A of the job talk deserves its own discussion. It's challenging. The best way for you to deal with that is practice. You just have to practice. The best thing you can do is give a mock job talk in your department. Ask them to please ask you very challenging questions and questions from left field that you know, not the standards, so that you can just get used to dealing with the unexpected and handling yourself.
And remember that those hard questions, if you answer them defensively or in some kind of reactive way, it's an indication of what you're going to be like as a colleague. And remember what I said, they're looking at collegiality. Mm-hmm. They're imagining you in a faculty meeting when you get your buttons pushed and they don't want to deal with it.
Yeah. So upshot.
Prepare.
And care.
Oh, wow. That's so cute.
I wrote that.
Prepare and care.
And by care, we mean care about them. Care about them, them as people, as scholars, as a department, as a university, as a campus, as a geographical location. Take your big research skills and use them to figure out what they do. It's fine to make cheat sheets. In fact, I want you to, and look at them on the plane as you're flying over. Look at them in the breaks in the day that you might, that I hope you have.
Look at them before you walk in the door. Open up your little portfolio, look and say, oh, this dude does this. He does this.
Yeah.
Oh, hi there.
Uh-huh. Yeah. If you have that moment to yourself, do that. Mm-hmm. But absolutely. Remember that to master your message is to learn that you have to know who they are and then adapt what you do to their needs.
And I'm going to leave you with one word to go to the campus visit with. One word. If I had 1 second to prepare you all for a campus visit, I would give you this word.
Mm.
Curiosity. Mm. Actually, be curious about the people you're talking to. Get over your terror enough and your fixation on your own stuff enough to just sit in a room and be curious about the other very smart, undoubtedly interesting person across the desk from you.
Mm.
That's all I have to say.
Nice. See you next time. Bye.